Sawbones is a show about medical history, and nothing the hosts say should be taken as medical advice or opinion. It's for fun. Can't you just have fun for an hour and not try to diagnose your mystery boil? We think you've earned it. Just sit back, relax, and enjoy a moment of distraction from that weird growth. You're worth it.
All right. Song is about some books. One, two, three, four.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Sawbones, a marital tour of misguided medicine. I'm your co-host, Justin McElroy.
I'm Sydney McElroy. You always try to add, like, make it a song. You're doing that a lot lately.
There's a great temptation. There's a great temptation to make it a song. You're 100% right.
See, there's already, you're not hearing it because we don't listen to our own theme song before we start recording every time.
Right.
But that did just play. You didn't just hear it, but it did. So it'd be like a song and a song. You can't do a song and a song.
There is. You're saying that there is already a theme song, so I don't necessarily need to do another theme song.
Right.
That makes perfect sense.
Like, why would you follow a theme song with another theme
song?
Makes
perfect sense, honestly. It makes perfect sense.
That would be confusing and disorienting for our audience.
Yeah, if there were two theme songs.
Mm-hmm. Well, because then when you're in the midst of the second theme song, you have to start to dread, like, is a third theme song.
Is there a third theme song? A third, yet less capable theme song on the way.
It would feel very like David S. Pumpkins, like singing.
Are you referencing the David S. Pumpkins animated special that only you and I and our daughters have watched? Yeah. You can't even find it on like streaming anymore. It's just we saved it on our Apple TV or something.
It's become like a Halloween tradition. And by Halloween tradition, I mean we watch it the entire month of October and, well, every other month of the year, always.
Constantly.
Because our children love it. But
pretty much verbatim. It's funny. It's got some good lines. Anyway.
and a great song.
Can you guys recommend a great David S. Pumpkins-based Halloween special? That's from Justin. No, this is we're going to do your questions and answers. Everybody loves it when we do these, and we love doing them, and it's just fun. Temperature's going up. You know, everybody's out there living their lives. So we are going to take your questions and turn them alchemy-like into wisdom, medical wisdom. Still not advice.
No, not advice. Just like it's the essence of weird medical questions are just like things you wonder about but aren't necessarily the – I mean, sometimes they're important for your own personal health, but sometimes it's just like a curiosity kind of thing.
Yeah.
As always, if it's an actual, I am worried about my body and my health question, you should ask your personal healthcare provider, not me, Sydney, the podcaster.
So let's get into it.
Do you want to read the question?
Yes,
or...
I'm going to read the question to
okay.
you. Okay. I'll inhabit the listener.
We'll do it.
Hi. I've been hearing a lot about we missed a few opportunities for COVID to become endemic. Or that once it's endemic, we're good, but I haven't actually seen anyone say what that means and what it looks like other than the vague idea that endemic equals good. Do you think you guys might be able to talk about this? Thanks, Erica.
So there has been a lot of talk about whether or not COVID has become endemic. I would say we're not quite there, but that is the direction that we're heading, as opposed to, I think early in the pandemic, there was this idea that a lot of people had that we were going to like vaccinate our way out of it and it would go away. Mm-hmm. And that is not going to happen.
Right.
COVID is not going to go away. People are going to continue to get COVID. Our hopes moving forward is that, and this is when people talk about something becoming endemic, what they're saying is that it will consistently be present. That's mm-hmm. an endemic disease is always there within a certain region or population or whatever.
Right.
But, it's more predictable because we know it's coming. Like we get the flu every year.
Right.
You know, in a lot of parts of the world, endemicity, we talk about malaria.
Endemicity? I don't think I've ever heard that word.
Being endemic.
Got it.
Like okay. Malaria is endemic to certain parts of the world. So it's predictable that people are going to get malaria. We know about how many people on average are getting something.
Right.
So what that allows us to do are several things. One, we can focus on effective treatments and, like, you know, continuing to evolve vaccines as needed, like we've seen with influenza. And two, it helps to keep hospitals and healthcare facilities from being overwhelmed if you know the times of year and what to predict and what to expect and those sorts of things. In a perfect situation, this would also motivate masking at appropriate times, you know, depending on what the levels are, you know, of COVID in the population at that moment or the situation indoor versus outdoor. And it would also encourage more people to get vaccinated so that when inevitably you do get COVID, hopefully it's not as bad.
Okay.
And to protect people who, for whatever reason, cannot get vaccinated or the vaccines don't work.
Mm-hmm.
That is sort of the direction we're moving. Levels are high right now in a lot of places here in Cabell County. I don't know if you know that, Justin.
Thanks. I didn't before, but it's...
You wouldn't know if you left the house. There is no indicators from anybody's behaviors or anything that the levels are high.
You don't really see masks ever anymore here.
Well, I mean, I work in healthcare, so I see masks all the time in the situations I work.
No need to brag.
But no, you're right. Outside of my workplaces, there really aren't here. But that would be what we're moving towards. We're not there. I think it's still really important to remember. So, like, using no risk, you know, preventative measures like masks, which are no risk whatsoever, is still really important. Depending on the level in your community. And monitoring yourself, using a test. If you think you're sick, like, stay home.
Been seeing it pop up a lot. Like, it's weird. Mm-hmm. Facebook's, I know this is confirmation bias, but I've been seeing a lot of folks on my feed getting sick. And I wouldn't say it's no risk, because when I'm wearing a mask, people miss out on half of the goods. You know what I mean? They're just getting the top half. Very good, but it's not the full goods.
We're not there yet. I would say that COVID being with us permanently, a lot of people were like, well, then we should just give up and go about our lives. No, we shouldn't do that. But we should, how can we live with COVID while protecting everybody as best we can, but also continuing on our existence? I mean, that there has to be a balance. It can't just be like, well, let's just throw our hands up in the air and all go get COVID at once.
And super quick reminder, kids under 5 still can't get vaccinated. So
it should be coming soon. Well, there's not a question about that, but they're in.
Oh, and boosters, by the way, we should talk about that last time.
Yeah. Kids, five to 12 can now get their boosters and should get their boosters. So do that. And hopefully by the end of this month, there will be a vaccine for kids under 5. Fingers crossed.
Recently, while waiting in line at the grocery store, a stranger standing behind me told me that there have been studies done in India that show that humming releases nitrous oxide, which kills COVID. And people in India have been curing their own COVID via humming. That is, can I just say, wild story. Yet wilder, just be like, hey, I'm a stranger. Excuse me. Can I tell you some wild stuff? I, a stranger, would like to tell you some wild thing. Obviously, this guy was spewing nonsense, but I was wondering about any potential theoretical kernels of truth to what he was saying. Does humming release nitrous oxide, etc.? Thanks, Natalie.
Okay, here's what's wild. So anytime I hear something like this, I don't just dismiss offhand, even though I know, okay, obviously humming doesn't cure COVID. I know that. We all know that. We know that. We don't have to be medical professionals to know humming doesn't cure COVID. But
might cure a gloomy day.
When you hear that, you have to think somebody did something. This comes from somewhere. Some sort of like nut. This isn't.
Grain of truth there.
Yes, there's something underneath.
A grain of something.
So, okay. There, I found some studies, specifically a Swedish study from 2002 that looked at nitrous oxide levels in the nose before and after humming. Does humming release more nitrous oxide? That's the first question. Is that true? Yes, it does. That is a fact. There are studies that have looked at, like, the contents of your paranasal sinuses. You have a couple different sinuses, right? You have a few different places, which are just like empty spots in your skull, which unfortunately can get infected sometimes. They measured the levels of nitrous oxide and found that if you hum, you will increase those levels.
Okay.
What is the utility of that? Well, in that study, what they were saying is, if humming causes this increase in nitrous oxide and also ventilation, like clearing, you know, ventilating the sinuses. Mm-hmm. Can you reduce the risk for sinusitis with this? Because nitrous oxide has been shown to prevent the replication of some viruses like coronavirus in a lab, in a, you know, under those studies. Well, lots of things do that, right? We've talked about this before. We have a great magnet that a listener sent us on our refrigerator that says, whenever somebody tells you that something kills cancer cells in a petri dish in a lab, remind them, so does a gun. Like, there are lots of things that can kill germs and bad things in laboratory settings that we can't necessarily translate to our human bodies, right? It's why we don't put bleach in our veins.
Yes, I remember.
So can nitrous oxide be utilized to do this in the human body? There's no evidence right now that, like, there is a clinical effect that we can expect. Yes, nitrous oxide might prevent the replication of coronavirus in a lab. What does that mean in the human body? We don't know. They've tried, in terms of prevention, I couldn't find anything that really, like, looked into it. That's a hard thing to say, right? Like, hum all day and we'll see who gets COVID. I mean, that's a wild study to do. So I don't have any evidence that, like, doing that would prevent COVID in real life. Now, as a treatment, they've tried it. They have tried during the pandemic in different places to give patients, and usually these were, like, very, very sick ICU on the ventilator patients, were given nitrous oxide to see if it would improve their rate of survival.
And?
Inconsistent. And a lot of the times it's like you're trying, especially during the height of the pandemic, if something was pretty low risk and you were trying it, you weren't just going to try it and want, like, try it in everybody who you thought was going to die anyway was sort of a, I mean, you saw this.
Are you saying, is it fair to say then that it's not, couldn't hurt?
Humming? No, I don't think humming would hurt. I think that one author wrote, in the absence of effective treatments or vaccines, humming could be a reasonable thing to do. So if you've got nothing else, I guess hum. Which is, I don't know if this is like just a philosophy on life.
Yeah.
But no, humming, we have no definitive evidence in any way that humming prevents COVID. There is a grain of truth in there about humming and nitrous oxide and nitrous oxide and what it can do to viruses in labs. So there is some sort of theoretical basis for it.
Right.
But to just say that everybody can walk around humming and they won't get COVID, no.
But.
No.
But. No. If you have COVID.
I mean, if you want to hum, hum.
Couldn't hurt to hum. It might actually be a nice little boost.
If you want to hum out, hum out.
Is that it?
I don't think that works as well as sing.
I got another question for you.
Yeah.
I heard that the acne medication Accutane turns your bones green, and this would only be visible upon autopsy. Obviously. That's from Adam.
So I, you know, it's funny. I took Accutane as a teenager. I'm familiar with Accutane. There are a lot of reasons to be careful with Accutane. It has a lot of dangerous side effects in some patients. You absolutely cannot take it if you are pregnant or could become pregnant, or, well, if you need to take precautions not to get pregnant while you're on it. Anyway, there are lots of risks with Accutane. I had not heard of this one. So I looked into it. I couldn't find anything linked to Accutane, the acne medication. This is where I think, though, there was a mix-up. So there is another medication that we do use for acne sometimes. It's an antibiotic. It's a form of doxycycline, which is in the class of antibiotics, the tetracyclines. And it's called minocycline. Minocycline can turn your bones green.
Okay.
So what I'm thinking is that this was the mix-up. This was the acne medication that, yeah, it can, in fact, do that. Tetracycline can turn them yellow. Mm. Minocycline can turn them a sort of green shade.
Okay.
And it has to do with the way it actually is taken up and binds to the bones. This is why for children, you have to be careful with these kinds of medications because they can have permanent tooth discoloration. Oh. And you'll see some people have that. Like, it took us a while to figure out. So you'll see some adults who have some permanent tooth discoloration or gum discoloration, and it's from being exposed to these tetracycline class of antibiotics.
That's wild.
Early on. Yeah.
That's wild.
But so it can turn bones, minocycline can turn bones green, tetracycline can turn them yellow. minocycline is used for acne. I think that's where that came from. All as far as I know, Accutane, with all of its other risks, this is not one of them.
Hello, doctors Sydney and Justin. Thank you. My boyfriend is physically unable to sit cross-legged, crisscross applesauce. I think it's because he doesn't stretch enough and that he should be able to if he just stretches once in a while. He will not try it. He thinks it's genetic and he'll never be able to do it. His brother and father can also not sit this way. It's actually common to not be able to sit cross-legged even if you stretch. That's from best regards from Agnes in Malaysia.
I don't know. I thought this was a really interesting question. I don't know of any reason genetically, outside of obviously there are sort of like there are syndromes, genetic syndromes that can involve lots of different clinical manifestations, signs and symptoms. And among them may be certain like physical limitations, but right. It wouldn't be just this. You know what I mean? There's right. not a genetic syndrome that says you cannot sit cross-legged, but that is the only, you know, that is the only issue related to it. So outside of those sorts of things, this is a common problem. As I started looking into it, I found that a lot of people ask this question, why can't I sit cross-legged anymore? Or I have so much trouble sitting cross-legged, or they're being told to do something like yoga or some sort of like exercise stretching kind of program. And part of it is sitting cross-legged and they can't do it. It's because there are multiple parts of the leg and hip that are involved in sitting cross-legged. And if any of those parts are having issues, it can be more difficult. So it's like a complex thing we do. Hmm. Sitting cross-legged is like a complex physical action. So if you have like problems with your hips, like weakness in your hips, or if you have like inflammatory conditions in your hips, it can prevent you from sitting cross-legged. Obviously, if you have knee issues, it can be weak glutes, your butt muscles.
Not me.
Right if you haven't been working your glutes,
powerful butt.
If your thighs are weak, there are lots of different reasons that you might have trouble sitting cross-legged. And I guess it sort of comes down to flexibility.
Yeah.
Yes, but it should be something that you can, especially if you go to like a physical therapist, that they could assess you and help you work on if it was a concern.
Or you just keep living your life.
Or you just don't sit cross-legged. But as far as I know, there isn't a specific genetic condition that only causes this issue.
Okay. There it is. I tell you what, do you want to take a break?
Yeah, that sounds good. Let's go to the billing department.
Let's go. The medicines that escalate macabre for the mouth. I have really enjoyed experimenting with fashion, thanks to Quince. Now, I know that sounds wild coming from me, Justin McElroy, a podcaster. Why, Justin, are you even wearing clothes? I hear you. But when I want to try a new look, what I love about Quince is they have a lot of different clothing items that are at a great price and are really well made. So if you want to try something, you're not sure if it's like, is this going to be the right fit for me? I don't know. Try it out with Quince. There's craftsmanship that you see in every detail of these clothes. I've bought several, like a pair of shorts I love, a pair of pants I wear literally every day. I mean, nearly every day, not literally every day. You know what I mean? Because there's some days you're just like, you can't. But I've been so happy with the pieces that we have gotten from Quince. And also there's a really wide variety of stuff. You know, there's silk tops, skirts for dressing up, denim for everyday wear. I don't mention a lot of the specific items because honestly, you shouldn't trust me about that part of it if it's outside my specific range of clothes for my body. But I will say this, for my body, Quince does right. It sounds weird now that I say it like that. Find gifts so good you'll want to keep them with Quince. Go to quince.com/sawbones for free shipping on your order. 365-day returns. Now available in Canada, too. That's quince.com/sawbones to get free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/sawbones. You know, it's tempting to say, I'm going to start on the big new thing. You know, when the new year comes, I'm going to get it all figured out. Here's what I want to tell you. There's never been a better time to start your dream than right this second. And there's never been a better way to start than with Squarespace. We've been telling you about Squarespace for years, and that's because it's simply
the best way to make a website. I mean, there's no other way to put it than that, folks. People have been using Squarespace to make incredible professional-looking websites. And they look professional because the templates they're using, they are made by real web designers. So they're making, like, building blocks that are going to look great. You just bring your stuff, your images, your things you want to sell, any of that, and Squarespace is going to help you make a great platform for it. Head to squarespace.com/sawbones for a free trial, and when you're ready to launch, use offer code sawbones to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain.
Hi, I'm Dan McCoy.
I'm Stuart Wellington.
And I'm Elliot Kalin.
And the three of us host The Flophouse. It's a podcast where we watch a new bad movie and then we talk about it.
Dan, you say it's hosted by the three of us. We've had a lot of great guest co-hosts like Gillian Flynn, Jamel Bowie, John Hodgman, Jessica Williams, Wyatt Cenac, Joe Bob Briggs, Josh Gondelman, Roman Mars.
Yeah, and you said new movies, but what about the time we did Meatballs 2?
Okay. Yeah, sometimes we do older movies and sometimes we have guests, but mostly it's about us talking about like recent bad movies.
And don't forget about the ones where I made you do a role-playing game where you played cartoon dogs.
All right, yeah.
Shouldn't a promo be a really simple explanation about what our show's about? So what's the show about, Dan?
What's it about?
It's
about friendship, all right? It's about our friendship and how we love each other.
The Flophouse. It's a podcast mostly about bad movies on Maximum Fun.
Do you sometimes wonder whatever happened to the kids at your school who really loved Star Trek?
You might remember a kid like me, the one who read the Star Trek novels and built starship models. I also took music classes to avoid taking gym classes that required showering after, but I don't see what that really has to do with—
Or a kid like me. I introduced myself to kids at my summer camp one year as Wesley. But when the school year started and some of those kids were in my new class, I actually had to explain to my friends that I had tried to take on the identity of my favorite Star Trek character. The shame haunts me to this day.
I'm sure some of those Star Trek fans from your childhood grew up to have interesting and productive lives, but we ended up being podcasters.
On The Greatest Discovery, you'll hear what happens to two lifelong Star Trek fans who didn't grow up to be great people, but just grew up to be people who love jokes as much as they love Trek.
So listen to our new episodes every week on MaximumFun.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back. Hi. Unfortunately, I have a question about poop. Why do some people poop out whole corn kernels after eating corn? People have been eating corn for thousands of years, so shouldn't everyone be able to digest it? And they say thanks, whoever wrote this in. Can I guess? It's just that you gotta chew it. You gotta chew it.
Yes, you do need to chew it, but that's not—
The outside protects it from your tummy.
Yeah.
So you gotta chew it.
Well, you do have to chew it.
Gotta chew it.
But can your body break it all down?
Yeah, no problem.
No.
Oops.
Corn is high in cellulose.
Oh.
Cellulose is a form of insoluble fiber, and your body cannot break that down, cannot digest that. But it breaks down all the other stuff in corn. So that's why, like, we still get stuff from corn. There are still things in corn that are—
something out of corn.
Yeah, you can still get something out of corn, even though we don't actually digest the cellulose. And like you said, cellulose is an important part of plant, you know, structure and protection and all that kind of stuff, which is why plants continue to have cellulose despite our inability to digest them.
Yeah.
If you chew it longer, you can access more nutrients. So there is some truth there. Like,
thank you.
If you break down more of the cell walls,
chew till you get to 22. That's my thing.
There is a way of preparing corn. I found this. Nixtamalization. Nixtamalization.
Mm. Wow.
And you soak the corn in lime.
Oh, it breaks it down. The acidity breaks it down.
Mm-hmm.
Huh.
And then you can actually enhance how much it is digestible if you go through that process. And that is used like specifically for like cornmeal, tortillas, tamales, those sorts of products made out of corn.
Huh, that's interesting.
When we were trying to figure out how to make arepas, I've stumbled across like looking for the right product that had been through this processing or hadn't or whatever, like the differences and all this kind of stuff. But that is why that's part of it. But it does make it more digestible. So, but yeah, that's why. So no, you can't break down the cellulose. So that's why you're going to see something in your poop. But if you chew it more, you won't see so much.
There it is.
If it bothers you.
Hi, Sydney and Justin. I was wondering if there's any sort of correlation between height and catching airborne illnesses. I'm 6'5", so my head is well above the zone where most folks cough and sneeze. I know it wouldn't matter if I'm in a room or in closed space for a while, but am I less likely to catch a cold when someone doesn't cover their sneeze on the street? Love the show. Chris, they, them.
You know, I had never considered if height would have a would make an impact. And so, but I assumed someone would have done the study. I couldn't find a study. It's so rare that when someone asks a question or if I think of a question that somebody out there hasn't already said, "Huh, I'm going to get some money and do that study."
It has to be
now,
logically speaking, it has to be better. It has to be at least some modicum better.
This is really conflicting. Through COVID, there were articles published where they didn't, okay, nobody obviously is going to, in order to do this properly, what you'd have to do is have a population of people above a certain height and below a certain height and expose them via sneezing or something in a room and see how many people get an illness, right?
Yeah, it'd be like, quite a production just so at the end of it you can be like, well, there you have it. I guess tall people don't get germs as bad.
Right. Nobody's going to do that. So, like, you have to do them retrospectively and look at, like, the heights of people who got different illnesses. It's hard to do. It's a tough study, right? This is tough. But what there was a suggestion during the pandemic at one point that tall people were actually more likely to get COVID.
Why?
Nobody knew.
Okay.
But then I saw some articles that suggested that, no, actually, tall people are less likely to get COVID. I don't think anybody knows is the point.
Okay.
Right now, I don't think we have any definitive correlation between your likelihood of getting some sort of respiratory illness and your height. Right now, I have no...
That was a long walk around for you to say, I don't know.
Well, it's interesting because there are people who have written about this. So I can see where, like, you might... Like, if you Google it and start reading, you'll find articles where people are like, oh, my gosh, tall people got COVID so much more. And other people are like, no. It was short people who got COVID more.
Do you remember that first few months of COVID where it's like every week you'd hear a different, like, here's the new thing? Anyway.
I think the thing is, it depends on the size of the droplet would be my other thing. You don't need large respiratory droplets to transmit COVID because it's airborne. And so height would play less of a factor. Whereas if you're talking about something that is only transmitted through large respiratory droplets, which won't go very far before they drop, right? Mm-hmm. Like if they're expelled from your nose because they're heavier, they're going to drop faster. Mm-hmm. Then that would, but and some illnesses are transmitted that way. Okay. So, but so, I mean, again,
you don't know.
I don't know.
My boogers and snot have recently turned fluorescent greenish yellow, like bright lime green with a tinge of yellow, and are opaque. This is grossing me out. Okay, come on, Justin, get it together. This is for the saw boners. I'm not sick, and nothing else about them is different. Am I dying? And then they attached a photo?
Of a color.
Oh.
It was a color square.
Okay.
Yes. And then they did not, this email writer did not want their name mentioned. Because then everybody would know about their boogers.
Everyone would know their terrible secret.
I understand. No, and they did not send me a picture of a booger. They sent me a picture of a color.
I don't want to hear the word booger anymore.
Okay. I just wanted to... This is always an important thing to return to because a lot of people will associate the color of their snot or boogers with, like, an infection. And certainly, if you do have some sort of infection... You can see a change in the color of your mucus because there's white blood cells that are, you know, there to attack things. And that changes the consistency and color of your mucus. Okay. So, yes, that can happen. However, it can also happen if it's more concentrated. So sometimes it's clearing out invaders and that's white blood cells doing that. Sometimes it has to do with concentration because you're dehydrated. Okay. So your mucus will get thicker and darker if you're not drinking enough fluids.
Okay. So increase the hydration.
Increasing hydration sometimes can change that.
My wife was recently gifted a small, about the size of a fly. I can't think of anything other than bugs. I don't know why. Piece of plutonium that their father got from a nuclear testing site. Knowing me well, they both stressed that I cannot eat this piece of plutonium. I know I probably shouldn't eat it, but can I? Would I survive? Would it have lasting effects? Or can I eat this tiny radiation rock? Friend, can I just say real quick, I don't know how long you've been listening to our show, but in what reality did you expect my wife, Sydney Small McElroy, to be like, yeah, go ahead and pop that bad boy in? You know you're not going to get permission here. Why would you come here for permission?
Yeah, let me preface whatever else I say with, do not eat the plutonium.
I'm going to go hog wild and say most rocks, she would say, don't eat it.
Yeah. I mean, generally. But don't eat the plutonium. If what we're talking about is, will this kill you? I mean, it really depends on how much plutonium it is. Mm-hmm. What happens is when plutonium gets in your body, it can get into your bones. It can become part of your liver. Like, and it stays there for decades. It doesn't go away. Mm-hmm. Like, it's there, part of you, for maybe your entire life, right? And because it's there emitting radiation for decades, it can cause cancer and sometimes immune system problems. And just generally, it's not good to be exposed to radiation. Exactly like, would that much do that to you? It's hard to say. It has to do with how much radiation it's emitting, which you can measure. And there are acceptable levels. You can look up all this. Like, there are acceptable levels of radiation that you can be exposed to through your life. That's really important for people who, like, work in radiology, right? You need to know how much radiation you can be exposed to safely. So I don't know that this fly-sized piece of plutonium would do this to you. But I don't know that it won't.
So don't eat the plutonium.
Don't eat plutonium.
Don't eat plutonium.
We're all going to get exposed to radiation in our lives.
Okay,
Let's not seek out extra.
I'm cutting you off. Hey, I was wondering how medical, especially hospital staff, strike. For retail, it seems reasonably simple to organize a mass walkout for everyone to quit because someone is unjustly fired. But in hospital, you can't just do that, can you? Do you guys even have the option to strike? Is there something you can do to make sure your patients are cared for, et cetera? So this is the question. Striking in the medical field. Hope you guys are staying healthy and safe. Gail.
I thought it was interesting because we've had strikes here recently.
Yes, we have,
at our
sure.
hospital.
Recently.
It was not the – so first of all, I don't know in this country. There are a few unionized residency programs, I think, in New York. But for the most part, doctors are not part of any sort of organized anything.
Yeah.
The AMA does not count. We have no way to strike.
It's a lobbying organization. Right?
Exactly. And they do not speak for all of us.
Very important.
There would be no organizational structure for doctors to strike, so I've certainly never seen that happen. I'm not saying it hasn't, but that is not going to be common. Certainly, like, other healthcare workers, like nurses and other staff within the hospital, definitely have unions and can go on strike and do. And this happened recently at our local hospital, and it was extremely difficult. I mean, it was basically the impetus was on the administration to figure something out. Mm-hmm. Because they didn't figure it out first by negotiating fair contracts. So they had to hire a ton of, like, temporary travel positions and that kind of thing to fill a lot of vacancies.
They know that the strike will come, right?
Yeah, I mean, part of it is that they're given warning for weeks and weeks and weeks.
Yeah, so you know you have to have a plan in place.
Yes, and so a plan gets in place to bring on temporary staff. And then, honestly, like, administrators were going around emptying trash and stuff and carrying laundry around.
Inspiring.
No.
Gosh.
No. And then a lot of stuff slows down. A lot of stuff slows down a lot is the truth. It was interesting. I went when I was working at a hospital in Malawi, I saw a strike happen. And it was like a soft strike. It's like a basically that they didn't want to, the nursing staff didn't want to leave the patients uncared for, but they also did want to get the message across. So it was like they would come in, like, just a lot of people would call in. So there would still be people there and you could still take care of the patients, but it would move a lot slower and it would be very frustrating for administration. Mm-hmm. So I thought that was kind of a cool message to send. We're going to take care of the patients, but we're going to make your life hard until you pay us fair wages and all the different things that they were asking for. But anyway, yeah, that is how strikes happen. And it usually is because there's a lot of forewarning given. And then you can, like, transfer patients to other hospitals or bring in travel nurses or whatever you need to do to try to fill those vacancies. What would be better is if we just paid everybody a fair wage and gave them good benefits and, you know, made their job enjoyable to have because it provides for their family and their life that they don't strike.
That would be great.
What about that?
That's a better plan.
That applies to all industries, I think.
My sister recently had some stomach ulcers that sent me down a rabbit hole of Googling acidity and water enhancers and energy drinks. I came across some information, who can say if it's reliable, that listed the pH levels of different soft drinks, energy drinks, and water enhancers. You ever find those websites? It's like, who is doing this? Who made this big list of caffeine content and diet sodas? Anyway, the information I got listed some drinks at a pH of 3.5. This is the same pH range as stomach acid. I've always been dubious of the way information is presented and want to know, does a pH level necessarily represent the acid power of something? Can I drink a soda and be fine, but I have vomited before and the stomach acid burned my throat, so what exactly is going on here?
You can find like studies where they list the pH of different beverages that are legit, like these are real. And this was, this specific study that I found was done to look at damaging dentition, like what acid level will damage teeth.
Okay.
And can we connect like drinking sodas and stuff like that with tooth damage? So it was done on behalf of the dental profession. But either way, it is true. There are a lot of beverages we drink that have extremely low pHs, not just sodas, which do. They're down in the 2. I have this big list in front of me. Hold on. Oh, there's my Diet Dr. Pepper. It's 3.2. Coke Cherry Zero is 2.93. Caffeine-free Coke is 2.34. These are very low pHs, by the way. That means more acidic. The lower the number, the more acidic. The higher the number, the more alkaline. But so, by the way, is lemon juice, as you may imagine. Incredibly acidic, and we can drink that.
Yeah.
Stomach acid.
We don't, really.
Well, but if you did, it wouldn't kill you.
That's true. Yeah.
You
ever do that? The miracle berries, folks. Get some miracle berries and try it. It's wild.
Stomach acid is actually a little lower than what you mentioned. That 3.5 is on the high end of the pH of stomach acid. It can be as low as 1.5. So, which can account for differences in like if you vomit and it hurts. The other thing I will say is like when you vomit, lots of stuff is coming up your esophagus in the wrong direction. There are lots of reasons it burns other than just the stomach acid. Whereas when you're sipping small amounts of a beverage, you're, you know, it's not going to hurt. But the point is, yes, the pH does mean the acid power of something. I think what you got to take into context is like our bodies handle acid pretty well. We have a lot of mechanisms to balance out acidic things and balance out alkaline things. So you can drink these beverages and they won't necessarily do harm. Now, obviously, if you do have something like ulcers where your stomach lining is more, you know, sensitive, you want to be more careful with acidic beverages. And they do impact dentition. They can damage your teeth. Mm. So.
You bet. You're just guessing there because you don't know anything about teeth.
Right? I read this study by dentists who told me. So okay. I wouldn't have known anything about teeth except the dentist told me.
What's up with the goop in your eyes? My eyes created goop. It seems to grab on a hair and other particulate in my eye and drags in the inner corner. What is that stuff? That's from McKenzie.
Do you know what the eye goop, sleep?
We call it sleep.
Yeah.
In West Virginia. I don't know if that's what everybody calls it.
So I've heard people call it eye boogers. I don't like that. So I call it sleep. You got some sleep in your eye or crusties.
Crusties.
Yeah. It's mucus, dead skin cells, and oil, and then tears that you cried overnight that sort of crusted in there too.
So it's the Sandman's sand. Got it. Okay, I heard it. Hey, folks, thank you so much for listening to our podcast. We hope you've enjoyed yourself. Hey, if you find yourself in need of some new, call it maybe clothing. You need clothing. You need pens, stickers, dice, mugs, notebooks, temporary tattoos, tiebreaker coins, whatever you need, head on over to MacRoyMerch.com because this is very exciting. All purchases this month, 10% of all our proceeds are going to Fairness West Virginia, which is a statewide civil rights advocacy organization dedicated to fair treatment and civil rights for lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender West Virginians, which is a great group. We've worked with them many times.
We have, and I'm excited that you all can help us support them.
So head on over to McElroyMerch.com and get some of that Great stuff. Thank you. Thanks to taxpayers for the use of their song Medicines as the intro and outro of our program. If you're going to be in the Boston area, we are going to be doing some My Brother and Me and Taz Adventure Zone shows up there in that region here in just, oh gosh, now I guess it's just about a week and a half away. So if you want to come see us, we would sure love to see you. June 17th, Taz is in Boston. June 18th, we got Mabim Bam in Boston. June 19th, we're going to be at Foxwoods in Mashantucket, Connecticut with Mabim Bam. You can go to McElroy.family and click on tours and get tickets to that. And we would love to see you there. So thanks so much. That's going to do it for us. Until next time, my name is Justin McElroy.
I'm Sydney McElroy.
And as always, don't drill a hole in your head.
All right. Yeah.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Audience supported.